Thank you, Ruby. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. This is the IRTPB call on the 24th of May. And on the call, we have Michele Nilon, James Bladel, Chris Chaplow, Mikey O'Connor, Paul Diaz, Barbara Steele, Matt Serlin, Barry Cobb, Simonetta Batiga, and Bob Mountain. And for staff, we have Marika Koenig and myself, Glenn de Saint-Gerie. Thank you, Michele, and over to... Yes, we have, sorry, apologies from Kevin Ertman and Anil George. Have I missed anybody on the list?
Don't think so.
Thank you, Michele. Over to you.
All right. Good afternoon, ladies, gentlemen, and Matt. It being Tuesday, it's the IRTP, so as usual, we've done our roll call. Now we will have the usual check to see, has anybody got an update to the statement of interest or declaration of interest? No? Going once? Going twice? Okay, moving on. Right then, one of the things today was... we were looking at was in relation to the emergency action channel. So there was a conflict of acronyms. I can't remember what the conflict was again. Now my brain's gone. Yes, Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. We can maybe first start with what's on the screen and then maybe move on to some of the other comments, if that's okay for you.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because basically what is on the screen is the email I sent out last week with a consensus call asking whether anyone had any further comments or problems with any of the language that we currently have in the EAC, as it's still called. And there were two things I highlighted that were based on Barbara's email that she sent, I think, last week just prior or just after the call we had, because there were still two items, I think, that the registries had concerns about. And the first one, I think, is addressed, as Section 6 of the IRTP actually states that, the five-day period within which an undo must be taken care of. So I don't think there's a need to further clarify that, as the EAC specifically refers to that section. On the second item, I didn't see anyone responding or providing any input, because as I understand it, the registry operators are stating that they don't want to reset the domain name to its original state, but they are willing to update the registrar of record to its previous state. And once that is done, the registrar of record would be responsible for resetting the other information, such as name servers. As far as I understand, Section 6, this actually is different from what is currently required in the case of a transfer undo, because Section 6 basically states that the transfer will be reversed and the domain name reset to its original state. I'm just trying to clarify from the group whether we need to provide specific exception then, what a transfer undo means in this context, or does the group feel that what is currently in Section 6 should also apply to this version of a transfer undo? So I'm trying to determine what if anything, is further required in relation to address this specific comment by the registry stakeholder group.
Barbara and then Mikey.
Thanks. This is Barbara. From our perspective, at least here at the VeriSign Registry, when we return a domain name, in our undo process that's published out there, I believe on the ICANN website, we specifically state that we will basically update only the registrar of record. So from our perspective, and I expect the perspective of the other registry operators based on the feedback that I got, registries feel as though the updating of the name servers and any other information relative to the domain name should really be with the registrar of record.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. Mikey?
Sorry, it took a minute to get off mute. I'm fine with all of this. I want to highlight something that's related, though, and that is that in the latest version of the FAQ. And it has to do with the placement of the may versus will. I think it's our intent with the placement of the may that the option to request a transfer undo stays with the registrars rather than the registries. In other words, if I'm a registry, I want a signal that simply says, do this thing, and then a clear policy that I follow that does that thing. And so this clarification that was on the screen a minute ago is fine with me, and I defer to the registries on that. But in the FAQ, what we said was, it's the answer to the question, what happens when the gaining registrar does not respond to an EAC request? And in the FAQ, it says the losing registrar the losing registrar informs the registry that they have not received a response to the EAC request, after which the registry may perform a transfer undo. And I don't think that that's our intent. I think that our intent on the placement of the discretion is with the registrar, not the registry. And so I decided to chime in with this point here just because it sort of fits in with the points that Barbara made, which, you know, my sense, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, my sense is that the registries want a very clear sort of black and white path. If this happens, then these things will happen by this route and consistent with existing policy. And by moving the may back up into the registrar area, I think we accomplished that. So that was the thought that I wanted to put out there.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. Marika?
Yes, it is, Marika. So just to clarify, so Mikey, if we would move basically that sentence around and say something along the lines of, if the losing registrar has not received a response to an EAC request, the losing registrar may request or may inform the registry and request that the registry performs a transfer undo. Does that address your
Marika, point? I just posted a tentative draft down in the chat because I rewrote this and then I decided it was easier to present this context on the call.
Right, but I think it's the way you write it basically means once a registrar informs, the registry has to undo. And I think as we have currently written the language, we're saying it's a may. There's no obligation.
No, and that's the whole point that I'm making, is that the may right now sits in Section 4, which is requirements on the registrar. And so it's up to the registrar to decide whether to request the undo. And then once the registrar does make that choice, then the registry has a very clear path as to what they do. And that's why I rewrote that sentence that way, is to clarify that. Because my understanding, and again, Barbara, you know, feel free to chime in here, is that they don't want to be put in an adjudicatory role. They don't want to be in a decision-making role in this. They simply want to be in a situation where it's very clear what they do, and it's consistent with existing policy. And the discretion lies with the gaining with the losing registrar as to whether to pursue that or not.
Okay.
Barbara?
I agree with Mikey's assessment of that, and I believe that the registry stakeholder group members would also be agreeable to that, basically just being consistent with the existing policy, and that to the extent that we did receive a notice that, again, you know, as Mikey mentioned, that we're not making a decision, we're acting on the notification from the registrar, and, you know, the assertion that they're making that's the situation and that we're trying to do it in accordance with Section 6.
All right. Thank you, Barbara. Marika?
That is, Marika. I still have a question for Barbara in relation to, returning to the registrar of record instead of changing the name service. Are you comfortable by it currently just pointing to Section 6, which, if I understand you correctly, that is what currently is in place and that, allows you to, do the same thing? Or do you think that still something additional needs to be written in or explained what is, covered under a transfer undo?
This is Barbara. I would prefer that it's updated to actually reflect that we would only be changing the registrar of record and that the name servers and any other changes would be handled by the registrar. Because that, in practice, is what, registry operators are doing today in accordance with the undo mechanism.
So is that something we can just clarify in the FAQ, which I think will provide as well as a kind of, implementation guidance to our legal and services team to make sure that they understand what the objective and idea behind the EAC is. Would that be okay? Or if you have some proposed language for the EAC itself, feel free to suggest it. Just to make sure that I capture it correctly at the right spot.
Yeah, I can take a look at the language and see if I can come up with something. Because in some cases, court orders actually do order us to make changes to name servers and maybe redirect, traffic to another name server. But that, again, is not, necessarily restoring it to where it was before the state, before the request or incident that occurred, I should say. So I can take a look at it and see if I can come up with something that would work.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Simonetta?
I'm just wondering if that achieves what we want. If only the registrar is changed, that doesn't necessarily mean that someone's website is up and running again, right? And I also wonder if, for example, in a SIC registry, the registrant isn't changed and it still lists the hijacker's information or some other entity's information, is then the transfer undo sufficiently well done from what the registrars need to take it from there, or would it be better if we made a distinction between thick and thin and say if the registry has the opportunity to update name servers or registrant information and things like that, they should be doing it? I don't know. I mean, this is more like a question to the registrars in this group.
Does anybody want to respond to Simonetta?
My hand's up, McKaylee.
Okay. Barbara, go ahead.
Okay. Barbara, I think that basically it gets us where we need to be, and it's mainly because once the domain name is back under the management of the registrar of record who had lost the domain name, then, obviously it's in their interest to go ahead and restore the name to where it was previously. They have the relationship with the registrant and would have also the history of what that information was. So, I would think that, at the end of the day, once the domain name is with that registrar of record, the previous version, they would act swiftly to make any other changes to correct the situation until, further communications can occur between between themselves and the other registrar, should there be additional conversations necessary.
James?
Yeah, McKelly, James speaking. I agree with Barbara. I think that there is a motivation on the part of the registrar once they have control to restore the other objects, particularly the name servers. I don't know that there should be a distinction between thin and thick. I think that this is probably true for all registry models.
Okay. Anybody have anything else further to add? General agreement from several people on that. Thank you, James. Marika is uploading something.
Yeah, it is, Marika. So this is the email that I sent based on the feedback I received from Tim, and I think here the main issue for the working group to consider is the title, and I know some suggestions have been made already, so maybe that's an easy discussion.
Okay, the title is currently EAC. I think I suggested that we add transfer to it, which I thought was just simple and straightforward. Does anybody have any issues with us renaming the process to transfer emergency action channel? Are there any good reasons not to rename it to something like that? James?
Hey, you know, as long as we're considering renaming this, I'm wondering why we stuck with the concept of channel as opposed to contact. I don't know. Maybe it's just a minor thing. I don't want to make a big deal out of it. I just thought that emergency action contact made a lot more sense than channel. But because channel means, to me, seems to describe the method of communication rather than the recipient. But I don't want to nitpick this. I just thought as long as we're re-examining the name, and I wanted to put that out there.
Thanks, James. Just Michele speaking as myself. I'm not wed to channel particularly, and contact makes perfect sense to me as well, so I'm more than happy to change it. Simonetta?
I wonder, Mikey, you said this came out of ESSEC a while ago. Was the intent about this there also just around transfers, or was the intent around having a communication structure open around other issues too, which then I wonder if we limit this in its naming to just transfer, we kind of close the door to that one, or would have to reconsider down the road, or I'm just wondering. I don't have an issue with being it named contact or channel or have the transfer thing in there, but I was just wondering if that's too narrow.
Mikey? Mikey?
Oh, sorry, mute. I was very eloquent. Simonetta sort of took a lot of the points I was going to make. The channel word came from the ESSEC report, and it's useful not to limit it just to the purpose that we're describing, I think. You know, additions to its purpose would have to be clearly brought through the policymaking process, but I'm actually, if backed into a corner, I'd like EAC better than either TAC or changing it to contact for all those reasons. There's actually a surrounding context that the channel word came from.
So, Mikey, just bearing with the fact, as I'm probably being a little bit slow today, so are you saying we should rename it or we shouldn't?
I'm actually saying we shouldn't rename it.
Okay. All right. But will you cry if we rename it?
No.
Okay. Barry?
Thanks, Michele. This is Barry. Believe it or not, I actually support Mikey on this as well. If we do narrow this down to just in the transfer realm, then, you know, I'm just trying to be forward-thinking that future policy development or something that comes up that may be able to piggyback off of this, you know, would prompt another name change or something like that. So I think kind of minimizing it just to EAC will leave that door open that maybe this is a platform that we can leverage for other issues that we find. Thank you.
Barry and Mikey, just because I think I know what Paul is going to say, so I'm going to actually preempt him slightly. Why would we want to leave that door open? Why
Mikey, speaking with his mouth full.
Okay, you can speak with your mouth full. It's okay. We'll try and understand you. I mean, from a registrar perspective, why would registrars sign up to agree to something like this, where the scope is not defined?
I don't believe that the scope is not defined. I believe that right now the scope is very clearly defined. However, if in subsequent very careful consensus policy making, for example, in the DSSA process, it turns out that a urgent return mechanism is useful in other contexts, we simply would then have to rename it. So that's why I won't cry if we put T in front of it, but it just means that subsequent policymaking groups will have to rename it again, which will confuse people. But in this policy, the scope is very clear. It's very narrow.
Okay. That's fair enough. That's fine. Paul and then Barry.
Thanks, Michele. It's Paul. Look, I respectfully disagree with Mikey and Barry. This working group has a finite mandate. It is focused on IRTP transfer-related issues. I fully support what Tim Cole said in his email about the title. We need to remain focused. I like James's point about, you know, changing it from channel to contact. And quite honestly, if future policy work, the one that Mikey started it, or any others, if there is a need for some sort of urgent return mechanism, their charters, their mandates will address that. We can make the changes when necessary. I don't think it's going to be this incredibly confusing thing for folks. So let's be more specific. Let's stay within our boundaries, our mandate. And for that reason, I support the TEAC acronym.
Thank you. Barry, and then James.
Thanks, Kaylee. This is Barry. My intent behind that was never to say that this is scope creep to allow us to open up SEV1 help desk all of a sudden between registrars. The point is trying to take a services view approach to this, and there are other interactions that go on behind the scenes. So that was my only intent. So we can name it whatever we want. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. James?
I think I generally agree with Paul on this one. I think whether changing the name of something actually changes its use, I think is more of a philosophical debate. But I do see Tim Cole's point in that if this is initially a registrar-to-registrar transfer-only communication channel, it's going to be a tempting target for other interests to want to participate in this communication network and to use it for other issues, such as maybe issues that are where the emergency and nature of the communication is less universally understood. So, I think if we can limit it now and then maybe make that a part of the context for other policies, I think that would probably be best as opposed to trying to anticipate that in this group.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to jump in? Okay, then. So we have... I'm trying to work out, do we have actual consensus on this of any description?
I think we're close enough, Michele. This is Mikey. I don't have real strong views on this.
Okay, well, I'll work on the basis that we have consensus on adding the term transfer. We have full consensus on adding the term transfer to the description, and we have consensus on changing it from channel to contact, which I think covers all bases. And at the moment, the boys are on the chat, and I'm just going to ignore all these silly acronyms that they're putting in there because it's terribly distracting. Okay, then. James, go ahead.
Yeah, to Mikey's point, I think it is important that we ensure that this idea is linked to the pedigree of that original SAC report. So if we want to reference that in the body of the report and the body of the recommendation, I think that'll establish that link, and we don't then need to have the burden of carrying a 10-year-old acronym with us, as long as we point back to it and say this is where the idea germinated. I think he has a point there. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, this is feedback from ICANN Compliance. For the, I presume everybody's on there. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. So there's an email I shared with you, I think, yesterday following some questions that were on last week's calls with in relation to enforcement or a non-compliance with consensus policy. So it outlined there the different mechanisms that compliance has, and I also attached a presentation that they provided at a meeting in Munich 2 weeks ago. There was one issue there, and I think some of our people already commented on that on the mailing list, where there was a suggestion that, you know, in relation to the response being required within 4 hours, that there might be valid reasons for why a registrar might not have responded. And I think, indeed, I think someone already noted that that will, of course, be the case, for example, in natural disasters, extreme circumstances. So it's a suggestion to maybe add something like, you know, absent extenuating circumstances, and preferably define what those extenuating circumstances might be, that would give compliance, you know, some more guidance in cases where a registrar claims that, you know, they had a valid reason for not responding, where, you know, compliance could then say, well, you know, these are the following valid reasons that the working group has considered, but, you know, the reason you're providing is not considered a valid reason in this context. So it was a question whether, you know, the working group would consider that as a useful addition, and what, you know, kind of examples or restrictions could be set on that that, you know, would make it easier for compliance to follow up on any kind of complaints in relation to, you know, responses not being received.
Okay, thanks, Marika. Sorry, lost the window. That keeps happening to me. Go ahead, James.
Hi, thanks, Michele. James speaking. I would like to mount against the idea of the policy enumerating some extenuating circumstances or exceptions. You know, we've wrestled with this in other groups, I think most recently in PEDNR, when we tried to outline different exception scenarios. I think that makes it harder for compliance, honestly, to try and capture all of those things in advance, and then to try and determine what you know, what exception was in play in any given scenario. You know, we're not talking about immediate deaccreditation based on failure to respond. We're talking about it just kind of serving to build a case history or a record of a registrar. I think that, you know, for example, one registrar might consider a massive earthquake slash tsunami to be an acceptable extenuating circumstance. I think the small registrars might consider a vacation or an overnight stay in a hospital for an important person to be an extenuating circumstance. And I think that once we get into that, we start getting into the sliding scale of judgment, and I think that it's best not to take a foot down, take a step down that slippery slope. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, James. Mr. Diaz?
Thanks, Michele. I fully support everything James said, and just wanted to underscore that, you know, very often what we're really focused on here is establishing a dialogue, just as we're not looking for registries to immediately take some action. I don't think we were looking for compliance to immediately start breach proceedings and deaccreditation proceedings against a registrar. You know, when we see a pattern developing, it'll be a lot easier for compliance. In all likelihood, most cases, one phone call or one email from compliance is going to get somebody with the program. So, you know, I fully agree. I don't think we should start introducing exceptions or trying to define extenuating circumstances. It is a slippery slope. Let's keep this as simple as we can.
Okay, thank you, Paul. And anybody else want to jump in here?
Chris here.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I think we should keep it simple. I think compliance will use sensible discretion. You know, I had a sales manager once, and he had more emergencies, family problems, children in swimming pools, diseases, and anything that you ever believed. And after a while, you begin to realize it's not exceptional circumstances. There's something going on, and I think compliance will use the same logic for repeated offenders. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Just actually on that note, I mean, that was something that I was also very wary of in an email I sent, I think, probably yesterday. Well, I can appreciate, I personally can appreciate the concept of extenuating circumstances, I would echo Chris's concerns that, you know, extenuating, you only have one aunt, one mother, one sister who can, you know, get hit by a bus or whatever. If it keeps happening, it's a little bit suspicious, and I would be concerned that it's constantly... Sorry?
I said, if you want to keep getting hit by a bus, it depends on how hard you push.
Well, look, not everybody gets to do it with those nice red buses now, you know? Where ours are terribly boring, so I think actually you get hit by them once and you're just dead. James, go ahead.
Yes, just very quickly. I mean, in my opinion, we've taken a lot of the teeth or consequences out of this recommendation. You know, there are no, as Paul was saying, there are no automatic registry actions to undo transfers. There are no automatic actions for compliance. Everything is just, you know, essentially it boils down to now, answer your phone promptly or you'll get a strongly worded letter. So I think coming up with further exception scenarios or provisos or reasons why we shouldn't have to, I think it personally is not a good use of our time. But on a more general note, I think it speaks a lot to the maturity of this industry that we have to continue to we're being requested to paint exceptions for smaller folks. I think that, you know, it's time to raise the bar on what we're expecting for providers of what we consider to be critical internet resources. And I think this is a very small step in that direction, but I think that is something that we should preserve as much as we can of the intention. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Sorry, bloody Windows gone nuts here. Not that I'm using Windows, the operating system, just Windows, as in the Windows on the desktop. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't work out. I'm fine with that, with what has been said on this issue. Maybe just to recap then on the EAC. So basically, I'll change the language that Mikey put in the chat in the FAQ, and then Barbara is going to suggest some language either for the policy language or the FAQ in relation to the, you know, what are the requirements or what is expected following a transfer undue by the registry. And I think that captures everything in relation to the EAC. Did I have that right? Was there anything else that needs to be captured or addressed?
Okay, guys, anybody else have anything they want to raise? Now is the time to speak or forever ever hold your peace? Simonetta!
I know this is not a very popular topic to bring up, but I would like to make sure that the 60 lakh day minority viewpoint is taken notice of and included. And if there are any questions or other additional items this group would like to discuss about this, then I think this would be a good time to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Simonetta, for raising this point. It wasn't on the agenda for the simple reason that, well, you hadn't sent the email at the time the agenda went out. And as per the new working group guidelines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I think we're meant to send out the agendas 24 hours in advance anyway. So, moving to this matter, which we'll shove under review of final report, I see Paul Diaz already has his hand up. Paul, please, go ahead. And please be polite to other members of the group, though I know you will be.
We'll try, Michele. Not trying to be argumentative. Well, at least not that much. Look, I just before, because this came in the inbox this morning, and so just before this call, I posted a response. And Simonetta, in a nutshell, I'm respectfully disagreeing with the minority position you're taking. I support what is currently the majority view. But my question for you is, we've heard throughout the working group's existence complaints about lack of data, and I'm tossing that one back to you. The question is, do you have any data that gets at this concept of multiple transfers, that is, transfers between registrars within a 60-day period? Can you quantify that for us? Because maybe we're just missing something, that this is actually a very common occurrence. from my experience working for a fairly large registrar, we don't see that at all. And so I'm kind of left wondering if your minority position is being driven by a vocal minority. And if so, you know, I'm kind of left wondering, well, is that really in the best interest of the broader community? You know, we're trying to make an incremental security step here by mandating the lock. And again, very important, and it gets at Mike Rodenbaugh's response on the list to what I've said as well, we're not trying to create draconian rules that limit people's ability to do things. Even within this working group, we've pretty clearly, in my mind, laid out a service that a party such as CETO or any of the aftermarket providers could provide. It gets at the whole idea that we've been kicking around, this change of registrant versus change of registrar. There are ways that you could accommodate what I believe is a very small subset of the overall market, give them what they need, yet we can have this broader policy in place to protect the security interests of the much larger share of the marketplace. So, you know, I'm sorry that I could only post my response a few minutes before the call got underway, but if you're prepared to answer or if you can follow up on the list, you know, I do hope that there's some good stuff for dialogue there.
Right. I saw your email, and it came a few minutes before this call, so obviously I did not have time to collect any data or even request the data that I would need to back this up. I think I could get to data about this. It's not something that I can get within 4 minutes, obviously, but I can share with you that there's numerous occasions where you would want to have a domain transfer twice around an escrow transaction. And I think that is a very common thing that happens all the time, and you probably don't see it if you're just one side of the transfer, because you wouldn't necessarily see this twice change of hands, because obviously you will only be involved with one of these transfers. And I can see how for you this may not look like it is something that happens all the time, but it is a very common thing around domain name transfers that are traded in the market and or just change hands between two parties, where two people come to agreement even outside of CETO. So I do see your point that you would like to see data on this. I don't think I can get this data in time for us to include it in this final report, if this should be final for Singapore. So my intent with putting at least the wording in there is so that whoever takes this report is either able to request the data and know what they should be asking for, and I'm happy to include a sentence that states this data should also be collected and taken a look at so that you can really make a good choice. But I don't think, I mean, we were not able to get to the how many hijacking cases data. We don't have any idea how many of these hijacking cases have the jumping issue. And I cannot get to enough data for the legitimate transfer pace quickly. So if we include this minority viewpoint, at least whoever takes this recommendation has an opportunity to understand what they need to be taken into account when they make their decisions. So I would, unless we change our mind, then we do want to open this up for comment again, which I heard from Jeremiah last week that this group decided not to do. I am hesitant to take this point out of the minority viewpoint because I do think it needs to be looked at. And I see your point, too. Obviously, it needs to be quantified as well.
Okay, thank you, Simonetta. James, then Barbara, then Mikey.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks. James speaking. I don't agree with the what's included in the minority statement. I don't think there's any surprise there. I do, however, support the process of including minority viewpoints. I want to make sure that it is included intact. in our final report and our final recommendations, you know, so that it's considered. You know, perhaps, you know, this section could also acknowledge that something like 90-plus percent of the registrars encompassing 90-plus percent of the market share already practice this, but, you know, I don't think that that's a huge issue. I think the more important case, and this goes to a little bit to what Paul and Simonetta were discussing, is that we have later on in our report recommended an issues report on the concept of change of control, and I can see that probably will, you know, dollars versus donuts turn into a PDP at some point down the road. And I would strongly encourage, you know, our colleagues from the aftermarket to get engaged in that PDP and to, you know, include as many of their clients and other folks in that industry as possible, because we've got a real problem here in that we have, we're using transfers differently. We're using them to do different things. We're not using them to transact names for the most part in the primary market. Is using them to ensure that there is a level playing field for competition and for competitive services. So I think that, you know, the only way we're going to make some significant progress and headway on these issues is to disentangle in the minds of people the idea that transfer is a change of control. And I think the only way to do that is to come up with a distinct, secure, and aftermarket-friendly change of control process. And that, I would hope that everybody that has strong opinions in this working group gets involved in that one when it comes up. Thanks.
Hi, it's Barbara.
Barbara, then Mikey, then Bob, then Simonetta.
Okay. I just wanted to point out, I obviously don't have visibility into, you know, domain hopping in the case of hijackings, but I can say that our experience at VeriSign with transfer dispute cases, for a while there, it seems like a lot of them that came through, in fact, the majority of the ones that came through, the domains actually went from one registrar to another registrar. That was disputed, but, you know, by the time it got to us, it had gone to yet a third registrar. So we had addressed that in our supplemental rules that accompany the whole transfer dispute resolution policy. And I think a lot of other registry operators adopted the same, I guess, process that, you know, if we do find in analyzing or adjudicating a dispute between registrars, if a domain name has gone to yet a third registrar, you know, we keep that registrar involved, and we let them know that we've received a dispute on it, and to the extent that we find that the transfer between, you know, the first registrar and the second registrar was not in accordance with the policy, then we reserve the right to basically be able to pull that name back from the third registrar and return it to the original registrar. So I just wanted to point that out. And then there was also, it seems to me, several years ago, ICANN had conducted a study, and I don't know if this is something that Marika, you know, maybe you can see if you can find information on, relative to domain hopping. And it seems like there were a lot of three-letter domain names that were being transferred from one registrar to another and then, you know, straight on to a third registrar. I like to refer to it as domain laundering. But it seems like there was a study that was conducted by ICANN several years ago looking into that, and it was a specific complaint relative to, you know, either one or two registrars that were kind of involved. It seemed like that activity was happening a lot amongst those registrars. So that might help us get some information as well relating to this particular topic.
Thanks, Barbara. Mikey, then Bob, then Simonetta.
Thanks, Michele. This is Mikey. I'm probably going to annoy everybody, but it seems to me that we are moving too quickly to a final report on this topic. And so I would, you know, I think what we are doing is we are driving to ourselves perhaps to a false lack of consensus because we're moving too quickly and too single-mindedly towards a Singapore deadline. And given the fact that this working group has already taken a very long time, I can understand the motivation for that. But conversely, because this working group has taken a really long time, does not, in my mind, make it necessary that we arbitrarily stick to that deadline. And just given the richness of this last 15 minutes of conversation, I would request that we reconsider the Singapore final report, no public comment process that we're following, and consider a more in-depth discussion of this topic amongst the working group and another round out to public comment after we've really run that to ground.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. Bob, and then Simonetta.
You know, just to, I think, Paul's point, I think the request for data on the hopping on the aftermarket side is totally fair. And I was just going to volunteer to do the same, and I'm happy to dig around and see if we can get some data on that as well, incidences that we've that we may have experienced on our side, and see if that helps to clarify the picture.
Okay, thanks, Bob. And who do we have next? We have Mikey. I'm sorry, I thought you were already there, Mikey. How did you manage to get back there? I'm confused.
Old hand. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. I was getting worried there for a second. I think I was losing my mind. Sorry, Simonetta and then James.
I just wanted to agree with James on one point, and this was one of my other recommendations or well, I guess points from the email I wrote before last week's call. Is like, should we take this piece and say, the working group, or we have this recommendation in there that we'll take a look at what is the difference between transfer the old school way with no ownership change at the same time and transfer the way it is used for lots and lots and lots of transactions today already that has ownership update at the same time with transfer between two parties. And as a part of this, that group that looks at that topic should also be looking at this. So this was one of my suggestions last week, to say we could take this recommendation and add some language to say that we recommend that someone take a look at the difference between transfer and owner update and how this whole thing works, and as part of that, they should also be taking a look at this. And then I have no issue with including this language, and also what my points were, so that working group has a starting point to go from, and also take Paul's suggestion to say, well, you should really be looking at all the data. I mean, the data about hijacking, the data about how many legitimate transactions have multiple touch points and all these things. I mean, this is all stuff that group should be looking at, and I think once the EAC or TEAC or whatever it's going to be called has been up and running for a little while, we have better data on that front, and I think it's up to the aftermarkets and other players in this world to come up with the data to back up my statement that there is considerable concern and there is legitimate uses for multiple transfers in relatively short amount of time. So I don't disagree with anyone. I just want to make sure that whoever makes the decision has an insight into all these things that one should be looking at to come to a conclusion.
Okay, thank you. James?
Hi, James speaking. Thanks, McKelly. Wanted to respond a little bit to what Mikey was saying. You know, I understand that a lot of folks are saying that this is, this is maybe something that's too big to tackle between now and Singapore. I just want to point out that this is something that we identified very early on in this working group, and then all of the oxygen was sucked out of the room with things like the ETRP and the EAC, and so we just never got to it. So I would be just remind folks that this is completely and totally a failure on our part if we don't come up with a recommendation here. However, if it is sufficiently contentious that we just feel like we just can't go forward with that, or if I end up in the minority on that, then my recommendation as a fallback, reluctantly, would be to include this topic in the recommendation that we have for an issues report on change of control, and that we add it to that and say, this is a part of that. This is a part of that confusion, the misapplication of the IRTP in commercial or transactional settings that is causing the concerns relative to the 60-day lock. Because I'm concerned that if we don't come out here, that it opens the floodgates for the 60-day lock after a domain name is initially registered, which is also sort of a universal best practice but not required in the same language. So, you know, I just want to point out that if we don't have a recommendation in this area, then it is a failure, I believe, of this working group, and that we should try to come up with something. Worst-case scenario would be to include it in that call for a change of control. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Matt, and then Mikey.
Thanks, Michele. Yes, Matt. I've chosen to remain silent for just about 57 minutes, which I think is a record for me. I'd just like to agree with what James said. I think what Simonetta has put out in terms of a minority viewpoint is certainly fine. I actually, you know, I appreciate Paul's point about data. You know, I worry that the search for data around this is going to delay this even further. So I would actually be supportive of just including the minority viewpoint as it is, because I do think that we do have a majority supporting the view that we included in the report about the 60-day post-transfer lock. So I think is my preferred way forward. But I suppose I'd agree with James as well, as if that is no longer the case, then I would be supportive of including it in the change of control recommendation. But again, my strong preference is to continue forward with the majority viewpoint, and this included as the minority.
Okay, thanks. Mikey?
I'm going to make just one last pitch for a little bit of delay. I mean, we've been at this a long time. We're all tired. We're all striving for a Singapore deadline. But I think we should step back. And, you know, I agree with James. I wouldn't call it a failure, but we didn't focus on this appropriately. And now we are sort of playing catch-up. And the sense I get, the intuitive feel that I get, is that we're not that far apart, but that we're rushing this. And because we're rushing it, we're missing an opportunity to keep a group which is way up a learning curve. I mean, you know, one of the good things about having spent all this time together is that we do know each other and we do understand each other's points of view, and we do seem to get quite a bit done in a very effective way. And I am just lobbying for a little more time to give this problem a bit more of a look before we... I mean, in consensus building, there is a point at which you have to say, no, we don't have consensus or whatever. I just don't know that I would be comfortable with myself if I didn't say, look, you know, a consensus building does take some time, and I'm not sure we've given this quite enough. So my encouragement would be drop the target back to Senegal and focus on this one between now and then. Get this one right. See if we can get it to the point where we really have a consensus view and can do a really good job of teeing up the discussion about change of control at the same time. But keep the team together to do it rather than just stopping. And
Mikey, as working group chair, let me tell you that if this is going to be moving towards Senegal, you're going to have to find another chair.
I'm perfectly happy to take that job. I do not think that it's appropriate for a chair to use his personal circumstance as a way to direct policy at ICANN. And
I protest that remark.
That is out of line. Sorry.
No, hold on, Mikey. What I would like to say to you is this, is that I cannot see, I personally cannot see how we will be able to reach an agreement on this particular point. I cannot see that happening. I do personally think that maybe this, it might be better addressed in some other fashion.
I think if the chair believes that we cannot reach an agreement, then we either need to change the chair or we need to declare that circumstance in the report.
Sorry?
I do not think it's appropriate for a chair to predetermine the outcome of a policy debate.
Okay. Well, if you don't like that, then I'm more than happy to either recuse myself or resign as chair.
I would encourage you to reconsider your remarks.
Barry?
Thank you, Michele. Hopefully I can try to mend both sides of this bridge right here. In general, I do think we're much closer than we are, but at the same time, I know that we have gone through this. Really, what's dangling out there is our absence of data. So my first question is, how long do we think it'll take to get some of this data? And if it doesn't take that long, will that impact the deadline for us publishing the final report? And then the secondary part of that question is, if for any reason, I think even if we get the data, my gut tells me that I don't think it's going to change much in terms of our majority and minority positions. Matter of fact, I truly believe that we'll still be going to print with a majority and minority position even if we did have the data. So the secondary question is then, could we not go ahead and package up for the final report with both the majority and the minority positions and turn it over to the council? And then let's think about how the council is going to handle this. Again, recognizing that I don't think a minority position is going to become a full consensus position. How is the council going to handle this? And if it will take us a while to capture the appropriate data, can we submit that under separate cover for the council to consider when they go to specifically vote on this particular consensus policy? Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. Simonetta, James, and then Marika.
I was wondering about the same thing. How quickly can we get to the data? And I think while it would probably be possible for me to come to some data on how often does it happen that you legitimately need to transfer multiple times, we have seen that we were unable to get to the hijacking data piece. So I'm wondering if what James was suggesting earlier with bundling this up with the other topic, and this has been kind of put out there for in 12 to 18 months. By that time, we have some data from the emergency action channel, and it also gives us enough time to prepare the data from the marketplace side of things. We could at least get the EAC in place to start collecting the data. If we get to the Singapore deadline now, then we will have the EAC up and running quicker, which will give us one of those data points we'll need to look at anyway. And I really wonder if there is considerable disagreement with that approach in the group that this makes sense to bundle together, looking at this piece and looking at this transfer and ownership thing together in one go, because the topics belong to each other. And by that time, you should have more of a base of data to look at to really come to good decisions, which we are currently lacking, which I also agree with Michele that short of coming up with this data, which we will not get before we have the emergency action channel. We will not really come to an agreement on this item in this working group, which I think we should strive to at least get something done now and then be aware that we need to revisit this topic and make sure that the people that revisit this topic have the information they need so they can understand what kind of data do they need to be looking for and what kind of questions do they need to ask themselves to come to a good policy recommendation, which I think, and that's the piece that I agree with Mikey on. We haven't spent enough time researching and focusing on, and in part we were unable to research it because we have refusal to publish one piece of data right now.
So which bit of data is that, Simonetta?
Sorry?
Which bit of data is the refusal?
We don't have the hijacking numbers.
Oh, okay. Right, sorry. James and then Marika.
Hi, Michele, James speaking. Wow. So I just wanted to kind of take a step back from this and maybe try to come at it from more abstract perspective. I think that there are calls for data, and we've seen this, in a couple of different subject areas. I don't know that that's going to help. And I'm not trying to be cynical. I'm trying to be as practical as possible. If I come out with data that shows X and Paul has data that shows Y, but I'm focused on the X and Paul is focused on the Y, then I don't know that the data helps close gaps in gaps of perception. If something is disproportionately harming my business, I'm going to focus on that rather than something else. So I don't know that requesting data is going to, lead us to the promised land. So I just wanted to kind of put that out there. Secondly, I think that if I'm hearing Mikey correctly, we want to, I get what you're saying, Mikey. I think the thing, the charged word that you said was Senegal, okay? And I think that a lot of folks are looking at this PDP and all the other PDPs and the possibility that we'll be chasing new GTLDs, after Singapore. And we just want to make sure that this topic and the future IRTP working groups don't get run over by an army of steamrollers that's possibly coming down the pipeline after June. So, I would just point out, and I think this goes back to what Matt is saying, is we've got here, what we have is a majority statement and a minority statement, or if Mikey shifts columns, then let's call it two minority statements. Going back to what Barry said, the council is going to be presented with two positions. They can decide status quo, or they clearly agree with one position or the other, or they can punt it to a working group. I don't know that that's something that this group necessarily needs to answer. I think it's perfectly acceptable to submit both the report and this statement and say, look, we couldn't get to an agreement here. We thought about data, but, data will only take us so far. We probably could have spent more time on this, but we, from a practical matter, we kind of spent a lot of our time on the first charter question and left this one dangling. I'm just trying to kind of bring everybody back to the idea of where we need to go from here, and I certainly strongly feel like we need to have this working group effort put to bed by Singapore or it and in potentially some of its future iterations will be lost. So, thanks.
Thanks, James. Marika and then Simonetta.
Yeah, this is Marika. On the question that someone raised, whether data could be submitted to the council at a later stage, I don't think that would be an issue, as I guess through the stakeholder groups or constituencies, additional data can be presented when the council deliberates this. But I do want to warn the group, because where I think that if there indeed is a position that is not fully supported or a minority viewpoint, or there might be additional comments or letters or campaigns on a specific recommendation, I do think it's very likely that the council might push this back or indeed have another working group looking at this. And listening to the discussion, it seems that indeed a lot is linked to this change of control and that some of the concerns relate to debate about that. So I'm wondering if it's worth just doing a little straw poll on this call now to see where people stand, whether people feel to include the recommendation as is with the minority viewpoint, and anyone who wants to sign up to that can do so, or whether there's currently more support for actually incorporating this under the recommendation that deals with a PDP on the change of control that specifically calls out this issue and further data gathering for consideration as part of that PDP.
Simonetta?
Well, you can put me down in the group that states that I would like this to be looked at the same time with the ownership issue. And I also wanted to make one additional comment on James's assumption that if the data shows X, people will not change their point of view. I think it will be, whatever the data says will give you an idea. Is this like 1 compared to 100? Is this 1 compared to 10,000? What is the relationship? And if the relationship is a very clear 1 between number of times where this would have helped and number of times you do transfers where those transfers would be problematic because of this recommendation, then I think both sides will have to state why they think this still doesn't justify one or the other course of action. But I think absent of this data, all of this is just what we call in German Kaffeesatzlesen, which kind of means like looking at a glass ball. You don't know. I trust that whatever group takes a look at this would be mature enough to take a look at this data and come to a good recommendation based on hard facts rather than gut feels. And I'm not saying that I wouldn't change my mind if I see numbers that point clearly in the direction that this relationship isn't right and in the recommendation worded here should be done. I just don't have anything to base this on other than my gut feel that we have tons and tons of legitimate transfers that would be affected by this and people that would feel very strongly that this should not be done versus when I take a look back at the survey we did with the same group of people around their experiences with hijacking cases, and nobody spoke up and said they have lots of them. So if I just thinking about these two things and I don't have numbers to back it up, I just have a hard time believing that this ratio justifies this recommendation.
Okay, thank you. James, and then Mikey.
Hi, Michele. So just to talk about data a little bit, I wasn't saying that people ignore or willfully step aside from data, Simonetta. That wasn't really what I was trying to communicate. I was just mainly saying that the data is interpreted. The data itself may be objectively true, but it tells a different story depending upon the different needs that the individuals have from the data. And so I think that that's unlikely to change or be swayed by the presentation of data. So I'm mindful that if I were to say, for example, that 1% of GoDaddy customers had blue eyes, let's say, that may be important to somebody. Someone might say, well, it's just 1%, 99% of your customers don't have this, so you're fine. And then but someone else might say, well, wait a second, that's, 100,000 people or something that need to be addressed. So, it's just it's a matter of proportion, it's a matter of need, and it's a matter of interest. And you can look at the same number and come away with two very divergent opinions. So I'm just cautioning against the idea that the data will always bridge gaps in perception. So, but not saying that it hurts. It never hurts to have more information. But I don't put myself in the column that it solves problems. I think it's actually just creates new things to talk about. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Mikey.
First, apologies for my outburst earlier, McKaylee.
That's okay. I understand where you're coming from, and I'm sorry if my comment came across in a particular fashion. That was not my intention. And I'm more than happy to discuss that with you offline.
Yeah. Well. Anyway.
Or online if you wish.
That's a bit. I'm sort of moving into the column that says this recommendation is premature. It's not supported by enough analysis, it's not supported by enough data, and it's not supported by enough public comment for me to be comfortable supporting it. I'll move into that column with Simonetta. And I would also point out that one of the things that the DSSA working group has been working on pretty hard, at least the leadership group has, is trying to figure out ways to get competitors to share very sensitive information in a way that protects them. Because if we don't figure out a way in that working group for sensitive and or embarrassing information to be shared with the group, but redacted and cleansed of any identity, we're not going to get to the bottom of a lot of the discussions that we are going to have. And I would suggest that we may have the same kind of problem to solve here when it comes to hijacking information. I'm not keen on the idea of walking away from policy that's based on data. And if it's any use whatsoever, I think that the DSSA working group in the next couple of months is going to figure out a way to handle sensitive data and protect the people about whom that data exists. And so that's another reason why I'm falling out of the column that supports the recommendation, is because I think with some time we can get better data, we can get better analysis, and we can get public comment on our results. And I wouldn't be surprised but that we could also get to consensus. But I'm very uncomfortable with trying to drive an arbitrary deadline based consensus around this topic.
Mikey, just one question, and I'm just one very, very simple question. Apart from this one recommendation, this particular one in relation to the 60-day lock, are there any other recommendations or points in the final report that you have any issue with?
No, I'm fine with
it. I mean, beyond, you know, philosophical, you know, choice of word here, choice of word there kind of stuff, which we've already discussed.
Yeah. No, I'm fine with the report, and I'm not too bad with this recommendation, but I'm pretty uncomfortable with the process by which we arrived at it.
Mikey, that's fine. I'm just asking just for everything else. I'm just trying to understand. Just to the rest of you on this call, apart from the 60-day, the 60-day thing. Is there any other topic that people are uncomfortable about? James, go ahead.
McKelly, this is James speaking. I wasn't necessarily going to answer that direct question. I think that the answer for me, from my personal position, would be no, but you know, we had a fallback position here, and it wasn't my first choice, and I'm sure it wasn't the first choice of others, although I think I and Simonetta said we could live with it, which was to bundle this recommendation into the call for an issues report on change of control to see if we can't draft some language there. Does that bring us back to a full consensus? And maybe we should try and test that question, because if the key concern here is that we don't have enough data, we don't have time to get the data, and we don't feel like we want to proceed without the data, then maybe folding it into that follow-up effort is, I mean, they're clearly related, so maybe that's the appropriate way to go. And then we can get rid of this majority-minority or dueling statements or whatever and just say, this is what the whole working group wants to do. It's not everybody's first choice, but we can all get behind it. So can we maybe test that question, McKelly, or I don't mean to...
So, okay, what was the actual question, James? Sorry.
The question is, if we took this particular recommendation and try with the objective of getting rid of majority-minority statements and just say, let's take this recommendation and say, in addition to studying the issues report on change of control, we should also look at the imposition of 60-day lock after a previous transfer and after the domain name was initially registered, because I think those are two sides of the same coin. And can we include that into the call for an issues report about change of control? Because if I think that gets to what a lot of folks want, and it gets Mikey and Simonetta some more time and some more data. So we're calling this, I guess, the last resort or the fallback position. If it's the last part or point where everyone is still on the same page, I think we should put that out there.
Okay, thanks, James. I think what we should do is just follow up on all of this via email. Let's punt backwards and forwards a couple of options and see if we can work through that. I think James has offered a very interesting possible solution that would kind of get past this. Does anybody have... just one thing. Just now on the Adobe Connect... how many of you would be in favor of adopting James's idea? I'm seeing six. I'll put myself down as well just to make sure that we're getting there. Chris, are you happy with that idea? You are?
Yes, I'm just finding my way through the buttons.
That's okay. That's okay. Okay, so everybody agrees with this. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. So what I can do based on our discussion now, try to, wrap this into the other recommendation and, put some new language out for consideration, highlighting in that email then as well what was discussed today to make sure that people that weren't on the call can see, where the group stands and express their views. But my question would then still be, I can get something out probably tomorrow morning early European time. How much time do people need to review this specific, wrapping this into the language and the rest of the report so we can maybe set ourselves a deadline for a review and actual publication and submission of the report? Or am I being too ambitious?
Okay, then. I see James has volunteered to help you with some of this wording, Marika.
Okay.
And Simonetta as well. I think the three of us can probably get this done pretty quickly.
So what's pretty quickly, guys? Let's talk timelines.
24 hours.
24 hours? Okay, good. I like that. That's nice and short. And because of,
I'm in Europe right now, though, so when it's later in the day for you, James, I won't be able to respond anymore, but I can tomorrow morning.
That's fine. I'll put something together, and then you guys can work on it while I'm asleep, and then we'll have something by this time. Close the day Europe tomorrow, close the day Europe Wednesday, something like that.
Sounds good to me.
And on the rest of the report, because that's still out there, how much time do people need to review that? Because once we have the language on this, it's easy to plug that in. But I don't know if people already had time to look at the rest of the report and go through that, and how much time people need, you know, to provide any kind of edits or changes. The publication deadline for Singapore is in principle on Monday. As I said, you know, we have a little bit of flexibility, as in principle, this is not intended for community discussion, but I think it would be good if we can get it out as close as possible to the date as well, to avoid that the PTC might look at us and ask us questions why we didn't submit it on the 30th. But we do have a valid excuse.
Okay. Well, there's a GNSO update, which I think it's on the schedule for that, isn't it, Marika?
On Sunday, that's correct.
Sunday or something. Yeah.
For now, but it might be changed if there's a board GAC meeting, I guess.
Okay. Let's proceed that way then. If we can try and get to drive this forward, then I think everybody should be equally unhappy or happy, depending on how you want to look at it. Are there any other matters that anybody wants to raise at this juncture?
So just the last question. So can I put out on the mailing list that people have until Sunday evening, close of business, wherever you are, to provide edits on the other parts of the report, noting that hopefully we'll get, you know, language out for this, you know, combined recommendation on the change of control and the 60-day lock, you know, sometime tomorrow, hopefully. Is that reasonable? People have until Sunday evening so I can finish up the report on Monday and get it out?
Sounds good to me, Marika. Does anybody have any issues with that? Anybody have any issues? Is that okay for everybody? Okay, then. If that's the case, then I'll give you back 3 minutes of your lives, and I shall speak to you all... actually, hold on a second. Am I going to be able to speak to you all next week? Completely confused. What date is next week?
The 31st of May.
Oh, right. Ah, yes. I actually won't be able to speak to you next week.
But if we get the report out, there might not be a need for an immediate call.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is that I am unavailable. I didn't realize I'm so confused about days. I confused Monday and Tuesday. I am not available next Tuesday. But if somebody else is available to handle this call and you want to have one, then please step up. James isn't available either. I think actually that's because both of us are traveling. Is there anybody who would be available to look after, to babysit this call next week if needed?
Kaylee, this is Barry. I can do it.
Okay, thanks, Barry. All right, then, if we need to have a call next week, then if nobody has any objections, then Barry will be kind of orchestrating. But hopefully we won't need it. Okay, then? And I'll leave you all to it now. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Kaylee.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Kaylee.
Thanks.